Welcome to Building Better Businesses, an ABA podcast. Learn firsthand from business owners who built successful ABA businesses. Utilize proven techniques and strategies to help your practice thrive. This is Building Better Businesses in ABA podcast with Jonathan Mueller.
Emily Varon is a board-certified behavior analyst with a dedicated focus on sleep-related behaviors. She has worked in the field of behavior analysis since 2000 and has devoted her practice to improving the sleep habits of children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder since 2010. Emily, welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
As am I. I mean, this is like a deeply personal issue for me, and it's something I've like grown to appreciate more in recent years. I know it's a huge thing for ABA business owners, so I'm pumped to dive in. And I want to start with just, Emily, like, what happens when we don't get enough sleep?
We basically rot from the inside out. we cannot function. I mean, over and over and over again, there's just been robust research that we basically deteriorate slowly, starting with our cognitive functioning, where an everyday average sleep-deprived person that just had bad sleep will feel brain fog, will feel clumsy, will make mistakes, will have accidents. We're more likely to get into traffic accidents. Drowsy driving is a thing. And that's just sort of everyday stuff. But when it's persistent and when we see it over and over and over for long periods of time, then it becomes corrosive on the inside, where we just break down, heart attack, obesity, stroke. And all of this is because we're not getting enough mental health recovery in our light phases of sleep and physical recovery in our deep phases of sleep. So if our systems aren't able to rest and do what they're supposed to do during sleep, then we just suffer the health benefits,
the consequences of that.
Degradation. Yes, the consequences. Thank you for giving me my word.
Yeah. Tell me more. Like, I want to hear, because I know there's REM sleep and then there's deep sleep and there's light sleep and then there's awake time. At least that's what like my Halo app and Apple Watch tell me. But can you break down a little bit? Like, what are those different phases and why are they so important?
Yeah, I mean, there are multiple phases. I think there's technically seven, but really we break it into REM and NREM. So REM sleep and non-REM sleep. So in our REM sleep, that's our dream state. Those are our lightest phases of sleep. That's where naturally wakings actually occur. We wake all night long. And it's in our light phases, our lightest phases of REM sleep. We kind of wake up, put ourselves back to sleep. And then in our deep sleep, our NREM sleep, we're basically in a coma, basically. Everything really shuts down except the important things that need to kick on into high gear to recover. So the cells regenerate, our gut health, our immune system regenerates and resets. Our heart rate actually goes down. So it gives our heart the ability to rest and have much lower output. That rest and recovery, if we're not getting it, that's what causes those heart attacks and coronary diseases and things like that. When our heart isn't resting during those deep phases of sleep, if we're not sleeping, we're not getting the rest. Our physical body isn't getting the rest we need. And in our dream phases is where we sort of process everything through the day. So we Matthew Walker, who is like my new guru, he wrote the book Why We Sleep. He says we sleep to learn, and we sleep to remember, and we sleep to forget. So this is where our brain sort of like detoxes throughout the night. We sort of offload the things we don't need, like, we don't need to remember where we parked at the grocery store in 2 weeks, right? That's a useless memory. Our brain needs to get rid of that, right? But we do need to remember where our best friend lives, because we go there all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Or where our children's school is. If we forgot that every day, that would be problematic, right? Mm-hmm. So there's certain memories we need to hold on to and certain things we don't. And the sorting of that happens in our REM sleep. Now, if we're not getting our REM sleep and we're not asleep and we're not like sorting through that, this is where we get all of this anxiety, depression associated with sleeplessness because our brain isn't doing the thing it needs to do during our REM sleep.
Wow. So sleep deprivation will actually cause anxiety, depression, as or does it exacerbate it?
They're correlate. They're bidirectional. Basically, if we are tending to be a little more anxious, or maybe we have some anxiety happening, new jobs, or you know, stress at work, or something like that, and we're not getting good sleep, we are going to feel the effects of that stress and anxiety more. It's not going to go away, where it may actually decrease and actually sort of lighten the load if we're getting healthy sleep. So if we're getting healthy sleep, the things that stress us out usually and usually cause us anxiety won't seem as bad or like such huge mountains to climb if we're well rested, because we can think more logically, we can think more critically, we think with a more sound emotional scale, right? We're not only doing thinking impulsively and emotionally like we do if we're sleep deprived.
Gotcha.
More level-headed.
Yeah, well, goodness knows, I always need to be more level-headed. But is that, you know, this phenomenon of like, at the end of a day, I can't remember like, oh, that lyric and oh, what is it? And then I wake up the next morning, it's like immediately comes to me. Is that some of the process of what
that is definitely a function of sleep? For sure. For sure, 100%. Mm. In fact, Matthew Walker talks about exactly that thing in his book, where sometimes when people are studying, they're cramming and they're trying to put more information in their brain. If they don't sleep, they're not going to remember it the next day. If they do sleep, they will recall it. Right. So it, you know, that system of recall, being able to not just like distant memories and not just like the names of people, but also, you know, textbook information, phone numbers, things like that. Mm. Although who needs to remember phone numbers anymore? Who does that?
Or directions, right? When you've got
who does that, right? Who looks at a map anymore? But
yeah.
I mean, brain function and our ability to, word retrieval, everything. I mean, we don't speak as well. We don't think as clearly. We're just not our best selves if we haven't had enough sleep.
Oh, that's interesting. So if I like, I'm struggling to pull a word, it might not just be because my 45-year-old, like middle-aged, like dad mind is, I don't know, moving toward dementia, but it could actually be because I didn't get enough sleep.
Yeah. I mean, we're less likely to be able to retrieve just memories and language is memory, isn't it? Right. Yeah, language is memory.
Well, what I heard you describing with heart attacks and other things, I mean, it literally like, chronic sleep deprivation leads to shorter lifespan. Is that?
Absolutely. Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's hard to quantify, right? It's really hard to say, oh, like nobody ever says this person died of sleep deprivation. Right. You can't, because it's a slow process over time where we're incrementally just getting less and less healthy. So interesting. I'll just share with you a quick story of a consultation I did. This was 2 or 3 years ago. The mother had a daughter. The mother came to me for a sleep consultation for her daughter, 16 years old. Parent reported she had never slept well through the night. Okay, fine. So when the child's not sleeping, the parent's not sleeping, right? It's not like kids don't sleep and then parents sleep through the night. That doesn't happen, right? Mm-hmm. If a child's not sleeping, an adult in the house isn't sleeping. Mm-hmm. Happened to be this mom. So the supervisor was on the call with me, and she and I were kind of chatting while mom was talking, and mom was saying how she hadn't, you know, obviously slept in 16 years and all this stuff. And I said, man, you know, on the side, I said, man, mom's going to start getting sick. And the supervisor messaged me back on the side saying she's had 2 heart attacks and was just diagnosed with diabetes.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, okay, now if you talk to a doctor isn't going to say, oh, it's because you're not sleeping, right? Very few doctors are going to really ask about that. So if she dies, she's going to die of heart attack or, you know, some kind of, you know, diabetes sort of thing, right? She's going to die from coronary problems, let's say, at, you know, 52, But it's really hard to say it's because of the sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
It's hard to say that.
So is there like data on what sleep deprivation costs our country, costs organizations or individuals?
Yes. So in 2016, the RAND Corporation actually did that exact study. And they found in the U.S. that the U.S. loses $411 billion a year due to poor sleep and sleep-related problems happening at work with employees or consumers or wherever it is in the chain. The U.S. was the top. I have to look at my notes, but the U.K. was second, a very far second at $40 billion. So we're talking about $411 billion. Second place was 40.
Yeah.
That's hundreds of billions of differences. I mean, we know that the United States is the least healthy country on the planet. We know this. Mm-hmm. That's not news. But why? I don't know. Could it be sleep? Who knows? On paper, it'll show up as heart conditions. On paper, it'll show up as obesity. On paper, it'll show up as, you know, whatever, mental health problems. But if we peel back that onion, it's entirely possible that that's all coming back to sleep.
Yeah, I mean, I'm picturing this like iceberg of like, all right, the top of the iceberg out of the water is like the heart attacks and other things. But the 90% underneath this pervasive like sleep deprivation is now freaking me out. Well, I've heard you describe in the past, Emily, that sleep is a universal negotiable in Western culture. Like, what do you mean by that? And why is that so damaging?
It's the thing we put on the lowest part of the totem pole. It's the thing we deprioritize the easiest. It's the thing where we go, well, I'll just set an alarm and wake up earlier and get it done. Or who cares? I'll watch the extra episode of Netflix because I want to, and you know, whatever, you know, I'll just go to sleep later. It doesn't matter. But it does matter, right? We know it matters, but it gets deprioritized. I mean, I have a personal hypothesis that I think from an ABA perspective, I think we were all punished as young children with bedtime. That bedtime itself became so aversive to us in Western culture, where we turn off the TV and go to bed, that now it's almost like we're compensating. It's like, well, I'm an adult. I don't have to turn off the TV. I can watch whatever I want because I'm an adult, right? I really do think that there's this kind of like maybe subconscious need to gain control back of our childhood or something like that. But it was always aversive. You always had to stop the really pleasurable thing and transition directly to the aversive thing. And we know from an ABA standpoint that that's the worst way to teach new behaviors, right? That's the worst thing to do, is to go from highly preferred to aversive. Right. It's not even like we're going from highly, you know, preferred to like less preferred to like, you know, something a little less preferred. No, we're going right from like TV to bedtime.
Yeah.
And you know, and so that's kind of, I think that that's sort of what sort of has planted the seed over time to people feeling entitled to their evenings, really entitled to that me time at the end of the day. Whereas if we were a little more conscious about embedding me time throughout the day, we would feel really grateful for the me time we get in bed, right? That 20 or 30 minutes of actually winding down and really doing that self-care.
Wow. You know, I went for like routine physical a few months ago, and my primary care doctor was actually very direct. He told me, Jonathan, beds are for two things, sleeping and sex. And I was like, whoa, hey doc, what's up? Mm-hmm. But is that sort of how we've evolved to think about our going to bed environment, our bedroom environment?
I think we have evolved to making the bedroom multiple uses. I mean, I think we work in our bedroom and we work in our bed. We entertain ourselves. We watch TV in bed. We watch our iPads in bed. We do, you know, we enjoy technology on our bed. I think maybe we've gone away from that. I mean, I think we need to get back to the bed being just for sleep and sex maybe. And maybe not even sex. Sex maybe has to happen somewhere else. I mean, maybe. And so that the bed is just for sleep, friend.
Truly for sleeping. Wow.
My husband knows that. Yeah. Do not bother me once I am in bed. That's too late. You missed your mark.
Oh, sleep is sacrosanct.
You missed the opportunity, right? Now the bed can be for winding down. Mm. Right. I use the bed for winding down. I'll read a book or do crosswords or Sudoku, or I'll journal, or I'll meditate or do some deep breathing or something like that. So that's, you know, for winding down, being in bed. In fact, I recommend being in bed for 20 minutes or so before lights out so that we really turn off our brain, right? So that we're focusing on something that's not, you know, TV or something stimulating, and definitely not texting friends and not getting any of that outside stimulation that's going to, you know, cause us to have, you know, intrusive thoughts and things like that.
What are the, you work with a lot of families of kiddos with autism. What are the sleep recommendations that you find yourself most consistently recommending to families?
Most consistently, screen time, getting rid of screen time an hour to 2 hours before sleep is expected, which brings me to the second half of that sentence, is when sleep is expected, because most people don't know when to expect sleep. So it's about hitting the right bedtime for lights out, right? Hitting that right bedtime, knowing when sleep is expected, so that we can prepare the body and the brain for sleep. Right. And so we can turn off our technology at the right amount of time before sleep is expected, so that we're not intruding on our ability to fall asleep.
Oh, so meaning you're reading, winding down.
Yes.
Calm, non.
Reading on paper. Reading on paper. Yes. I just talked to someone. This was 2 days ago. She was like, well, I use the Kindle Paperwhite. And I was like, well, what happens when you're in bed and like the lights are dim? She's like, oh, there's backlighting. So here I'm Googling Paperwhite lighting, but LED. The backlighting on the Paperwhite, which is supposed to mimic paper, is LED lighting, and LED lighting stops melatonin production. And there we go down the rabbit hole of not being able to sleep because of melatonin.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these things, like, this is complex and multivariate, and it feels like you know, little challenges is in one aspect, like a parent who's got a kid. And even I've got three kids, right? And my kids, I don't think, some are awesome sleepers, and like one of them's not the most awesome sleeper. But that just compounds, right? The challenge.
Yeah.
But so we're going to do something for the first time ever on the pod, which I'm super excited about. And I'm going to be like vulnerable right now that I'm pretty nervous. But we're going to do like a little mini sleep consult of me. And if you're up for it, Emily,
I am.
And just sort of take me through, and I'll be sort of the guinea pig. And hopefully we can figure some things out. And this will be educational for our listeners.
Yes. Oh, I'm so excited. Okay. So usually I would start with the person's age, but because I see you, I know you're not over 50. And I know you're not under, you know, you're not pubescent, you know, you're not in puberty, right? So I can guess your age is somewhere between 24 and 45, 46. Yeah.
Bingo. 45.
Okay. There you go. So I'm 47. And so we are getting into that hormonal stage where at 50, our melatonin is going to slow. So the production of melatonin does slow around the age of 50. So I'm kind of preparing for that. You can kind of have that on your horizon as we start seeing it being harder and harder to fall asleep. But really, under the age of 50, melatonin shouldn't be a problem, and we shouldn't need to supplement it. Okay, that's the side. That's my side comment that
I'm
gonna sneak in there, right? Okay, so what is your main sleep concern? What's the main problem you're having with sleep?
Well, my recently purchased Amazon Halo app tells me I'm consistently getting fair to poor sleep every night.
Okay. On the front end, in the middle, waking up too early, multiple night awakenings, falling asleep, taking too long to fall asleep. What would that look like?
You know, I think it's not feeling super rested in the morning. I don't have a huge problem getting up, and I can usually, I mean, my alarm is set for 6:40 every day.
Do you ever beat the alarm, or do you have to wake up to your alarm every day?
Oh yeah. I snooze it 2-3 times.
What time does the alarm actually go off?
6:40. And then, on average, I'd say out of bed by 7:15, But when I said it earlier, I don't know, I might set it for 5:36 if I have work to do or things to accomplish, which I know is bad. And then that will, then I might snooze it, you know, a few more times extra.
Okay. Gotcha. Now, what time do you aim for bedtime?
What time does my iPhone tell me I'm supposed to be going to bed, or do I actually?
Well, here's the difference. What time do you get into bed and what time do you actually fall asleep ish?
Yeah. So I, on good nights, like when I'll read to my kids and they'll fall asleep by 8:30, 9-ish, then, mm-hmm. you know, I could be in bed by 9:30 and then asleep by 10 and things are generally good. Now, when I put them to bed and then I just have to unwind from the end of the day and I go down and watch the Netflix episode or two or three, then, you know, maybe that's midnight. Maybe it's 1 a.m.
So midnight to 1 a.m. And so then I would ask, like, how many nights a week are you actually falling asleep at 10? And how many nights a week are you actually falling asleep between 12 and 1?
1 to 2 at 10 p.m. Okay. The rest later.
So you're not getting enough. You're not offering. So you are the guy that we were talking about in the last conversation where you're not offering. You're not even offering yourself 8 hours in bed.
Hmm.
You're not even budgeting. You're at the beginning of the night. You're saying, I'm not going to get 8 hours of sleep tonight. You're committing to that at the beginning of the night.
So I'm like, right? I'm losing the race before the race even starts.
You're losing the race. You know, you're on the side like everyone else is lined up and you're drinking a beer.
Right, right. Well, so that's another thing. Like, and I try to be very mindful of this. I would say I might have 1 to 2 beers a night. Sometimes I'll have 3 or 4 or more. I live in Colorado, so occasionally eat a gummy. How do those things, you know, influence sleep?
Terribly. So... All bad news, Jonathan. It's all bad news. I just said this to a girlfriend just like 15 minutes before I got on. I was like, honey, I tell bad news to people all the time. Like, I'm like the dream crasher around here. Okay, so let's talk about sedative sleep.
Mm.
Alcohol, gummies that contain THC. Now, there are gummies that don't have THC. They're just CBD. If it's just CBD in the gummy or in the lotion or in the whatever, I mean, like I use CBD, but there's no THC in it.
Gotcha. Right?
The THC is the sedative, not the CBD. Okay. So alcohol, sleeping pills, and any kind of THC infused anythings are sedatives. Now, in order to understand a sedative effect, we have to understand normal sleep. So normal sleep goes through, like we talked about at the beginning, light, deep all night long, right?
Yeah.
Light sleep, deep sleep, light sleep, deep sleep. We cycle through all the phases all night long. Most of our light sleep at the end of the night, most of our deep sleep at the beginning of the night.
Okay.
Sedative sleep looks like this.
Mm.
Right? If you go under anesthesia, you're not sleeping. You're asleep. But you're not sleeping. Okay. You're not going through your cycles of sleep. So you're not getting the restorative effects of your REM sleep, like we talked about before, the mental health. Mm-hmm. And you're not getting the benefits of the deep sleep where you're recovering your physical health.
Mm-hmm.
So sedative sleep looks like this until the sedative wears off.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go like this.
Yeah. So you're drawing a horizontal line. It's not the light nor the deep. And then at the end of that, it wears off.
Oh, correct. Like, yes. No, I'm looking at myself in a video. I'm not imagining the podcast listeners who are only listening. Yes. Up, down, up, down, up, down versus straight across.
Uh-huh.
Right. So you are not getting cycles of sleep really when you have that sedative effect. Not only that, with alcohol, the sugars and alcohols take a longer time to break down, about 4 hours. So sometimes we wake up really sweaty and confused and feeling yucky, not like nauseated, like we're going to be sick. I mean, then you're like super drunk and then like, you know, whatever, just enjoy yourself and enjoy your hangover. But, you know, just a normal amount, like a glass or two of wine or beer or something like that. Once those sugar alcohols and all the alcohol actually, which is a toxin, detoxes through the liver 4 hours, let's say, after you drink it, that process does something different in your body and can cause disruptive awakenings as well as it breaks down. So, look, best efforts is not to use alcohol to fall asleep, not to use THC to fall asleep, right? If you're going to use these things recreationally and you get it, then just assume you're going to, and if it's night, you're going to have crappy sleep, and that's okay. Like once or twice, three or four times a month isn't going to set off your whole entire system. But when we're relying on these things for sleep, there's another bigger problem. Why can't we actually fall asleep? Is it that we don't have a usual fall asleep time? Probably. Is it that we don't have a normal wake up time in the morning? Probably. If we're waking up at 5 o'clock some mornings and 7 o'clock some mornings, and then sleeping off our entire sleep debt on the weekends, and we're sleeping until 10 or 11, which now that we have older kids, like I have older kids, I could sleep until noon and the children would never know. No one would care because my kids, you know, they feed themselves, they, you know, toilet themselves, you know, they don't need me. What I'm seeing as your, I feel like I'm fortune telling here. What I'm seeing as like a main problem is consistency, like, right? Your consistency with waking up in the morning at a consistent time and offering yourself bedtime at the same time every night. Mm-hmm. And then also sabotaging your own sleep by not even not offering yourself 8 hours of sleep, knowing your alarm is going to go off at 6:40 and still going to sleep at 1 a.m.
Gotcha. So 10:40 is when I need to be falling asleep to even give myself that starting
you
point.
You need to be, yes. And then if you do that for a week, you're going to find yourself not even needing to set an alarm. I don't set an alarm unless I have to be awake before 7. If I have to be awake before 7 for whatever reason, like I have to pick someone up at the airport or something like that, I'll set an alarm. But otherwise, I'm asleep between 10 and 10:30 and I'm awake every morning at 7 because I need 8.5 to 9 hours of sleep. Me personally as a female, females need a little bit more sleep. I need a little more sleep. So I need to make sure I'm offering myself 9 hours in bed so that I get between like 8.5 and 9. For most men, 8 hours is fine. For most people, 8 hours is fine. It just depends on how emotional your day has been, how stressful your day has been. You might want to offer yourself a little more time in bed if you've had a really stressful, active day, you know, for that mental health help. I mean, like you're like, if you just follow those two pieces of advice, right? Like just make sure you're waking up around the same time every morning within a half hour, making sure you're putting yourself lights out. Not like I'm getting into bed and relaxing 8 hours before sleep. you want to make sure lights out offers you at least 8 hours in bed, and shut off the TV and stop, you know, the booze and the, you know, the gummies every once in a while, because that's not helping, right? It's not helping. And then opt for some other more like relaxing activities. That blue light, the TV kills us because there's no end to it, right? Yeah. On Netflix, it'll just go to the next thing or recommend other things that you'll like. It's like this algorithm is killing us. Like, okay, I just binged watch like 3 seasons of Stranger Things. Oh, but look, here's the Umbrella Academy. Oh my gosh, I heard about that. That looks so good. Episode 1. It's 2 in the morning, episode 1.
ABA practice owners, are billing and insurance issues getting you down? Well, let me tell you, Element RCM is your answer. Element provides world-class revenue cycle management services, contracting, credentialing, authorizations, billing, and more. Element's your partner, so you can focus on what you love to do, providing the highest quality services to your families and clients. Element's a preferred partner of the Behavioral Health Center of Excellence, and its founders have nearly 20 years of experience owning and operating successful ABA organizations. They understand you. They know that every dollar counts. That integrity is everything. Element works with any practice management system. And Element's not a vendor, they're your partner. So find out more and take a free revenue cycle assessment at elementrcm.ai. Well, I want to tease on a couple other threads here. Sorry, not to complicate this consult further, but you know, I'm a founder or co-founder, co-CEO of two companies in our space. And like many listeners who are owners and ABA practice owners. And so my wife, Kim's hypothesis is I'm just under this like sort of perpetual stress, this low-lying stress. What role does stress play in not getting good sleep? And how do you detect that or
I would say you're probably so stressed because you're not getting consistent sleep. See, I think that if, you know, people who are in high pressure jobs, who have a lot of stress, if you rose to the point where you can manage two companies, like, right, like co-found, own two companies, you probably have pretty decent time management. You probably have pretty decent emotional intelligence, communication. You probably have pretty decent self-awareness and awareness of the people around you, probably, right? So in that respect, you know, if you think that the stress is the thing that's not letting you fall asleep, I would say maybe. But I would think that if you have good work skills and you can shut it off by, let's say, you know, you're the owner founder, you're kind of at the top. So let's say you shut it off by 6:37, mm-hmm. right? And you have that good self-management, that gives you hours to do the things that you need to do that maybe don't involve the stresses of the day, and maybe you can compartmentalize it. If it is the stress of work, then you probably need to work on, you know, doing, you know, your exercise and making sure you're exercising, making sure you're journaling, making sure you're doing, you know, if you need some, you know, therapy or, you know, life coaching or something like that to help you with the stress and with the mindset and stuff like that. I mean, that's one thing. Those are things that can help. But usually, unless you're just like laying up in bed, like eyes wide open and all these racing thoughts and it's stress and you're like, yeah. Oh my gosh, that report is due and I got to get that budget into that person. And oh my gosh, I never got back to that guy or that lady's waiting on my email. Oh, if those thoughts are what's keeping you up at night, then I would say, yeah, the stress is impacting your sleep. But if you're sitting here going like, yeah, Netflix is kind of keeping me up, I'm going to go, okay, it's that's probably right, not the stress.
Yeah, I gotcha. What about that idea of exercise? So some of the things that I haven't been nearly as good about this recently, but like I used to love getting up at like 5 a.m. and going for a mountain bike ride, and then I'd feel so good the rest of the day and be exhausted at the end of the day. Yep. But are there recommendations around like exercising at night versus morning and how those might interfere with sleep?
I recommend exercising during daylight hours, unless you live in like Alaska when it's dark like all day. You know, unless you're listening, tuning in from Iceland. But basically, if you can stop your exercise by like 7 o'clock, let's say, we don't recommend late night exercise because it increases your core temperature and your body needs to be on the cooler side to be able to fall asleep more efficiently. We need to lower our core temperature, which is so funny because I tell this to parents all the time. Parents who are like, yeah, we run them around to get their wiggles out before bed. I'm like, okay, well, let's not do that. Because that raises the core temperature and that actually delays sleep onset. Mm-hmm. So as long as we're exercising like earlier in the day during kind of like normal waking hours and not during our bedtime wind down routine and things like that, gentle yoga, stretching, things like that are fine, you know, before bed, but really nothing that's going to raise your heart rate, nothing that's going to make you sweat, nothing that's going to like kind of get your motor running. We want it to be cooler. So I love the idea of waking up early and exercising as long as you're adjusting your bedtime accordingly. Because if you're waking up and you're truncating your sleep by an hour, hour and a half just to exercise, I mean, you can eat all the kale. You can be ride Ironman triathlon, you know, whatever. You could do all that. If you're not getting sleep and you're not recovering appropriately, there's going to be the health benefit is going to be like an even scale. It's like there's not going to really be that health benefit.
It's a push.
Right? You have to sleep to recover and to prepare.
Yeah.
Or you're going to have a heart attack on the treadmill. I mean, that's what's going to, that's, those are the guys that have the heart attacks on the treadmill. They're so healthy.
Oh, wow.
But they go, and then they just drop dead because they're, you know, not sleeping, deprioritizing other things, you know, and it's like, you know, get your sleep. You have to sleep to recover and sleep to prepare. Your muscles, your heart, everything really needs that. You need sleep. You just need sleep, right? So that would be the answer about the exercise, really.
Gotcha. So I was once told, like, don't ask questions that you don't want to know the answer to, but here goes. I have a ferocious sweet tooth and sometimes late night, midnight, and I'm going to go grab some brownies or eat something else. I'm guessing that's probably not best.
I'm going to say it's not great, but it's not the thing that's killing your sleep. It's probably not. Unless, I mean, look, the chocolatey stuff has caffeine in it. So you want to kind of beware the hidden caffeine and like green teas, black teas, tea infused ice creams, coffee flavored ice creams usually have coffee in them. But the sugar itself, it is not really the thing that's going to be preventing your good sleep. Unless you're really spiking your blood sugar like heavily at the end of the day, like really packing it in.
Like eating a whole large pizza.
Yeah, I mean, that's just going to give you like nightmares and stuff. I mean, that's just going to make your gut unhappy. Yeah. I mean, look, now they're really seeing that, you know, not having, you know, that having a more empty stomach actually contributes to better sleep overnight. I'm not going to state that as fact because I don't have like research off the top of my head to spout out. To spout off to you, but they are, I have been kind of seeing these things like, hey, you know, like 2 hours before bed, 3 hours before bed, you know, going to bed with a, more of an empty stomach really lets your, a lot of the heavy lifting and heavy work that happens overnight in your deep phase of sleep is in your gut. It is in your gut and your gut health really, I mean, like immune system, you know, nutrient breakdown, digestion, absorption, all of that really starts in the gut. So the gut is one of your parts that go into high gear while you're like while your heart and your lungs sort of rest. So like gut health, stomach, digestion, breakdown, all that kind of cell regeneration, red blood cells, white blood cells, replicating things like that, red blood cells, all of that really gut centered stuff really happens overnight. So I guess it's just better to not have your stomach doing something else, like digesting food that has just been consumed would be my assumption. So yeah, I mean, look, we don't really, they're finding we don't like sleep great after a really heavy meal. We might fall asleep because of the postprandial dip, because all of our blood has now rushed from our extremities and our brain into our stomach to help digestion, which is what happens after Thanksgiving or like a big Christmas meal or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I snack at night, you know, I mean, it really just depends on what you're snacking on. And are you snacking because you're bored? I mean, sometimes that's the thing is that like, sometimes I'll get snacky and I'll look at the time and I'll be like, I'm just going to bed. Like why? Yeah. I know I'm tired. I'm tired and I'm bored.
Yeah.
Am I going to now eat and then watch more Netflix? By the way, Netflix is like their stock is going to crash after this. Yeah. Poor Netflix. No, I mean, like, am I going to push myself to go like more entertainment so that I can eat? No, me, Emily, I'm going to bed. Peace. Yeah. Good night. I'd rather not eat. I talk about JOMO all the time. You know, like people talk about FOMO, like the fear of missing out. I have JOMO, the joy of missing out. Like, get me out of here. Mommy needs to sleep. I was always that guy. I was always that guy. My friends would be out of the bar. It'd be midnight. I'm like, what? Another bar? Good night. I'm taking a taxi. I'm going home. I like my sleep more.
What's the role of something like, I don't know, like caffeine? So I know my body is super sensitive to caffeine. And I'll have one or two cups of coffee in the morning, maybe a Coke Zero during lunch. But is are there certain rules of thumb?
Yes.
Caffeine.
Yes. Usually it's like no caffeine after noon, but it really just depends on what time you go to bed. Here's the problem with caffeine is that it has a, it's in competition with a chemical that naturally builds up in our body all day long called adenosine. So adenosine, we start producing it in the morning when we wake up and it builds over the day. And that's what creates what we call sleep pressure. That's what increases the reinforcing value of sleep if we're going to talk ABA here. but adenosine is what basically makes us feel tired at the end of the day. So what happens with caffeine is caffeine actually blocks our sensation of the adenosine buildup. So adenosine continues to build, right? If you're looking at like my hand, like moving up a mountain, right? Yeah, like I'm slowly climbing the mountain. It's as if you have kind of like gone from like the base of Mount Everest to like the second camping point or whatever. And suddenly like you're screaming for oxygen because you haven't had the opportunity of that kind of adjustment along the way. normally we wouldn't feel adenosine building up. You know, it's kind of like, it's like those scales again. If you have the scales on either side, you know, we're putting pebbles on the scale of adenosine. And as it gets heavier and heavier and heavier during the day, the scale sort of like starts to tip and the scale sort of starts to get heavier and go down. Whereas like with caffeine around, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock, someone just puts a boulder on your scale and then your scale just like drops. And so that's when people get this afternoon dip. And what do they do? What do they think they need?
More caffeine.
More caffeine, right? But caffeine takes 8 to 10 hours to metabolize.
Wow.
Right? And so then how does that impact our sleep? Right? So the answer isn't necessarily no caffeine. I mean, I drink caffeine every morning. I love my ritual. I drink literally ritualistically because I love it. I put milk and sweetener in it and I drink it over like 3 hours and I just kind of sip it. I don't drink it for the caffeine. I don't drink it for the rush. I drink it because my husband's making a pot and that's a routine. That's a ritual we enjoy together. And, you know, I kind of sip it all morning and whatever. So I don't really feel that dip, but people who drink their coffee for the caffeine hit, it hits and then it metabolizes. And once it metabolizes 8 hours later, around 3 or 4 o'clock, they're running to Starbucks. So the key to that is just getting over that. If you are going to, here's the vicious cycle is that when you use caffeine in a way that's going to make you more awake in the morning, you're really just self-medicating that sleep loss. People who need caffeine in the morning have had poor sleep. You don't get a really awesome sleeper who absolutely needs caffeine in the morning to get going. You get someone like me who enjoys a cup of coffee in the morning, right? I enjoy my cup of coffee in the morning. Sure, it makes me feel a little bit more awake, but it's not like I would be fine without it. To the point where I go days without it. Like my husband was traveling. I didn't make myself coffee. I also didn't get a headache at the end of the day because I don't need it, right? I'm not using it for purpose. Like he was gone. Our ritual, so I didn't make myself coffee. It's a big deal. Yeah. So I drink iced water and that's it. Be done. I mean, caffeine is an interesting little legal,
a legal high, right?
A legal high. And people are very addicted to it chronically throughout the day. And then we wonder why we're sleep deprived. And then we give ourselves all the sedatives at night. And then we're drinking wine at night. And then we're doing THC at night.
Yeah.
It really is. We have ourselves in a very vicious cycle. And I think this is where that $411 billion loss comes from, is we don't know what we don't know when it comes to sleep.
Yeah.
Right? You don't know how sleep deprived you are, even when you're sleep deprived. Research shows that as well.
Interesting. Really,
you misreport. Interesting. Just like when drunk people misreport, like they're like, no, yep, I'm fine to drive. Same thing with sleep.
No kidding. Absolutely. All right. Let me throw one other curveball at you then. So as an adult, gosh, like 7, 8 years ago now, I was diagnosed with ADD and generalized anxiety. So I'm on Adderall or like generic amphetamine salts. And I take an extended release pill in the morning and another pill and then one, which I try to do well before 2 p.m. But how is that interacting with my sleep? And is that potentially?
So that would be something where you would need to do a little bit of a reversal for yourself at a time where it's not really like where you don't need the medication in the afternoon, because I know, like, you know, you can maybe go on vacation and be fine without it. You know, you don't need to, be really attending or focused or something like that. Everyone's a little bit different with how they metabolize drugs like that. So it really just depends on your own body and brain chemistry. So I wouldn't really be able to say. What I can say is that stimulants are stimulants. Right. Mm-hmm. And so some people with ADHD don't necessarily experience that stimulant effect because their brain isn't creating the thing that they need. Right. The dopamine. Right.
Exactly.
It's the dopamine regulation. Right. Now, Are there other side effects of, you know, hyperactivity too? Could be, but if you're just using it for focus, like, you know, ADHD has that hyperactivity part in it too. Yeah. You know, so if it's having an opposite effect where this stimulant is actually bringing you down, I'm not 100% sure that it's necessarily impacting sleep. But sometimes we do see, especially with kids who are on stimulants, a comorbidity of inability to fall asleep. So then we really have to look very closely at how that child's body is responding. So what I always say to adults is, do you think it's impacting your sleep? Are you having trouble falling asleep? Like I said before, are you laying awake with your eyes blinking open and a million racing thoughts and you just can't shut it down? Or are you like laying there peacefully and you're able to drift off once you actually offer yourself the opportunity, right? So I think there's not really a hard answer there. I think the answer is it's a stimulant. If it's a stimulant, there's a risk that it's going to impact your sleep. How your body responds to that, you know, it's not like caffeine or it's just universal. Now, some people metabolize caffeine quickly. It's not a lot of people. I know a lot of your listeners is going to be, oh, that's me. I metabolize the caffeine very fast. Oh, caffeine doesn't touch me. Caffeine doesn't affect me. Just because you don't feel it doesn't mean it's not happening.
Gotcha.
Right? But Adderall, those kinds of stimulants are a little bit different. We run into this also with like asthma medications as well, where, you know, it's a stimulant or a steroid effect too, that can mess with sleep a little bit. So sometimes we have to talk to our doctors about timing of medications, you know, and work with the doctors to maybe see if there's a non-stimulant alternative or something like that. Sometimes we have to work around those obstacles, but it's important to have that information to know that it could be part of the equation.
Gotcha. Emily, do you recommend that people use like a sleep diary or sleep journal or something that like as a feedback mechanism?
Yeah, I think it depends on your personality. We spoke about this briefly. If you get, if you're like a go-getter and you're like trying to like top your best night of sleep, that might end up backfiring on you and it might end up like causing you more stress and anxiety. So you kind of have to know yourself in that way. But if you are just interested, if you're just coming at it from like, gosh, I'm really curious how much sleep I'm getting. What I like to encourage people to do is actually tell yourself whether you slept well or not, and then check your app.
Interesting.
Say, did I wake up feeling really rested or did I wake up feeling like garbage? Because then that information that's on the app or whatever you're using is going to be more meaningful. If you can say to yourself, God, I really feel like crap. And then your app confirms, yeah, you slept like shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then you're tuning into the feeling. So that now you know how it feels when you don't get good sleep. And then if you're well rested and you're like, God, I feel like I have a pep in my step today. Let me look at my app. Oh my gosh, I really did cycle through really good sleep. Wow, now I'm in tune to that feeling. Now it's more of a self-monitoring system and you're just looking for that affirmation. It's also important to know if you think you feel really great, but you slept like garbage, to understand, oh gosh, I'm telling myself a story. I might be lying to myself. I might be thinking I can get 6 hours of sleep and telling myself I'm feeling great, but uh-oh, the data is going to show me that actually 6 hours of sleep is supremely insufficient.
Yeah, that's where sleep deprivation actually causes more incorrect perceptions of whether or not
we're sleeping.
Well, Emily, what's one thing that every ABA business owner should start doing and one thing they should stop doing?
Oh gosh, they should start educating their BCBAs on sleep and helping our families get better sleep so that we can have better outcomes for the families and to really improve and enhance the quality of life for our clients. I mean, that's really the foundation of ABA, is enhancing the life of others, the quality of life, you know, and really making meaningful changes. But also having better expectations for your employees to not burn the midnight oil. This is really epidemic in the ABA world, is this misuse of daytime supervision time or session time, and procrastinating our report writing and doing it at night when we get home. When I was working with an ABA company, one of the things I really tried to commit to, educating the people I supervised and oversaw, was time management and how to write your reports during session and how to communicate to families, hey, your child has an upcoming report. I'm going to be taking 30 minutes of session time for the next 6 weeks, and I'm going to be interpreting their data. I'm going to be talking to you. I'm going to be adjusting their goals. I'm going to be looking. I'm going to be actually watching your child to see if my data supports what I'm seeing, right? Because if they're 100% responding to their name, let's say the data, but you notice that mom calls the child's name and the child doesn't respond, I'm not going to master the child from that goal. Yeah. I'm going to update that goal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because what I see is different from what the data shows, right? So using session time and using your supervision time to write those reports is really important so that you're not going home and doing that work at night. So I think the more business owners can encourage staff members to utilize their daytime hours to get things done, and not kind of procrastinate it and, you know, not answering emails at 10 o'clock at night. I mean, one of my first supervisors did that to me, taught me terrible, terrible work habits. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would email her like just with a question. She would respond right back 10:30 at night. Oh, I'm supposed to be up and asking these questions at night, right? I would be on the phone with her at 8:30 at night, problem solving. I mean, it was terrible.
Oh, got to put that shit on extinction.
It was terrible. Yes, I should have, but I was 20 nothing, yeah, right? Yeah, I was 20 nothing, absolutely. You know, 20 years ago. And I learned the hard way that that's just not, you know, a sustainable way of life. And not that this is I'm almost embarrassed to bring this up, but she actually passed away from coronary disease. And she was 56.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, these things are real. When we are in a supervisory position and we are also modeling bad habits to people, deprioritizing sleep, prioritizing work at night, that get it done attitude, that, you know, not having great time management during the day, misusing session time, you know, really not appropriating the right amount of time to the right tasks at the right times, right throughout the day. I mean, this is where that $411 billion in losses comes. You're going to have burnt out BCBAs.
Yeah.
And they're going to leave.
And we can't afford that now as a field.
And we cannot afford it as a field. We cannot afford to be losing our BCBAs. So educate them, educate yourselves, set the standard, you know, be the role model. You know, put in reinforcement for getting 8 to 9 hours of sleep. Put in some reinforcement for that. Like that. Have a self-care challenge, you know?
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of things we need.
Well, Emily, where can people find you online?
ReadySetSleep.com. That is my website. You can get asynchronous CEUs if you're a BCBA listening. If you are a business owner, you can have in-services, CEU in-services. So I can come in and provide CEUs directly to your staff, or wellness seminars as well. I can come in and talk about sleep to your employees for employee wellness. All of that can be found at ReadySetSleep.com. I'm on LinkedIn, Emily Varon, and I'm on Instagram at ReadySetSleep with a little underscore at the end.
Well, this has been so much fun. Are you ready for the hot take questions?
Yeah, I kind of read them and I was like, geez, oh, Lord. Okay, I'm ready.
Here we go. So, Emily, you're on your deathbed. What's one thing you want to be remembered for?
I'm changing my answer to what I thought, because I thought I was going to say I want to be remembered for sleep, but no. I want to be remembered for being wise, not smart. I want people to say she was wise. That's what I want people. That's what I want on my tablet, whatever you call it, your gravestone. She was wise. Nice. Right. I just think that has a little bit more of an emotional intelligence tilt.
I like it. What's your most important self-care practice?
Sleep. Hands down. It doesn't get any better than sleep for self-care, period. Reward yourself at the end of the day with 8 or 9 hours of sleep.
Nice. What's your favorite song?
Okay. So anything by Erasure. I'm sorry. I'm like an early 90s, 80s girl. So I'm going to go with Au L'Amour, Erasure. Nice.
You have a great voice. We'll have to do a separate pod. On that, if you could give your 18-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I would say own your own business. Figure out a way to take what you're good at and make it your own. I think I spent a lot of time making money for other people. And I think I missed so many opportunities early on to do it for myself. And there's just so much more pleasure. Now I'm just enjoying my life so much more being a solopreneur than working for other people. I feel like it's enabled me to work with people more, right? That kind of balance, working with them instead of for, or, you know.
So true. All right. Well, you can only wear one style of footwear. What would it be?
The slippers. I walk my dog in my slippers. I relax in the backyard in my slippers. I lie in bed in my slippers.
That's
slippers
awesome.
For life.
It goes with the sleep motif.
It goes with the sleep motif. I love like just relaxing. I mean, I'm great at self-care. That is the one thing I can, maybe that's what I want to be remembered for is the girl who took care of herself. Self-care.
Emily, thank you so much. I have learned so much about sleep and I have my homework and to-dos on it. And I appreciate you sharing your wisdom. Thank you.
Yes. Oh, I appreciate you having me. This is a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
What up, listeners? Hey, I got something for you. If you like my Building Better Businesses in ABA podcast, you're going to love the Behavioral Observations podcast with Matt Sikoria. So I recently met Matt at ABAI. And let me tell you, I was just an instant fanboy. Matt's the real deal. His pod is all about stimulating talk for today's behavior analysts. So session 191 on his pod is on the behavior analysis of lying. That's right, lying. How awesome is that? Who does that? He also talks social skills, ACT, FAs, and so much more. His guests include Greg Hanley, Jonathan Tarbox, and other legendary names in our field. And as a BCBA, you can even get CEU credits through Behavioral Observations. You can find Matt and the Behavioral Observations podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast channel. Enjoy, friends.
Thanks for listening to Building Better Businesses in ABA podcast. Stay tuned for our next exciting episode. In the meantime, please like, subscribe, share, and comment. We value your feedback. Don't forget to follow us on social media at elementrcm.ai.